Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Nau mai, haere mai. I'm John McDonald, kia ora, and welcome into the Community Drive Hut Zone on Thursday the 13th of November. The Hut Zone is Wellington Access Radio's weekly look into the stories, people, history, poems and music that make the Hutt Valley community. Tonight, we hear about the launch of a new album from Let's Planet's Alan Galloway. It's being released to mark the band's 40th year. It launches at Meow Bar next Wednesday, so we chat to Alan and sample some of the music off the new album. We hear the final part from the audio archives of the Historical Society of Eastbourne with the memories of a long-term resident, Mary Hunt, and there's another Catherine Mansfield short story reading from In the German Pension. Today we'll hear Frau Breckenmacher attends a wedding. So let's start things off with a poem from former Wainumata reporter Rebecca Burgess.
Reduced. Right of home, a childhood lost, a mother screaming for her own voice. Months of time that wasn't her own, fighting to be heard in a man's world. She raced cars, you know, a champion, before they fried her brain. She was never the same. Those memories scattered on the floor. The cleaner may have swept them up. She became nothing, a clown around town, reduced and reformatted. How a treatment could dissolve is beyond me.
That was Rebecca Burgess reading Reduced from her latest poetry collection. And we will hear a little more from Rebecca later in the show. Time for our short story reading of the week, another story in Catherine Mansfield's 1911 book, In a German Pension.
Frau Breckenmacher attends a wedding by Catherine Mansfield. Narrated by Harry Dobby. Getting ready was a terrible business. After supper, Frau Breckenmacher packed four of the five babies to bed, allowing Rosa to stay with her and help to polish the buttons of Herr Breckenmacher's uniform. Then she ran over his best shirt with a hot iron, polished his boots, and put a stitch or two into his black satin necktie. Rosa, she said, fetch my dress and hang it in front of the stove to get the creases out. Now, mind you look after the children and not sit up later than 8:30 and not touch the lamp. You know what will happen if you do. Yes, Mama, said Rosa, who was 9 and felt old enough to manage 1,000 lamps. But let me stay up. The bub may wake and want some milk. 8:30, said the Frau. I'll make the father tell you too. Rosa drew down the corners of her mouth. But, here comes the father. You can go into the bedroom and fetch my blue silk handkerchief. You can wear my black shawl while I'm out. There now. Rosa dragged it off her mother's shoulders and wound it carefully round her own, tying the two ends in a knot at the back. After all, she reflected, if she had to go to bed at 8:30, she would keep the shawl on, which resolution comforted her absolutely. Now then, where are my clothes? Cried Herr Breckenmacher, hanging his empty leather bag behind the door and stamping the snow out of his boots. Nothing ready, of course, and everybody at the wedding by this time. I heard the music as I passed. What are you doing? You're not dressed, you can't go like that. Here they are, all ready for you on the table, and some warm water in the tin basin. Dip your head in. Rosa, give your father the towel. Everything ready except the trousers. I haven't had time to shorten them. You must tuck the ends into your boots until we get there. No, said the Herr. This isn't room to turn. I want the light. You go and dress in the passage. Dressing in the dark was nothing to Frau Breckenmacher. She hooked her skirt and her bodice, fastened her handkerchief round her neck with a beautiful brooch that had four medals to the Virgin dangling from it, and then drew on her cloak and hood.
"Here, come and fasten this buckle," cried Herr Breckenmacher.
He stood in the kitchen puffing himself out, the buttons on his blue uniform shining with an enthusiasm which nothing but official buttons could possibly possess.
"How do I look?"
"Wonderful," replied the little Frau, straining at the waist buckle and giving him a little pull here, a little tug there.
"Rosa, come and look at your father."
Herr Breckenmacher strode up and down the kitchen, was helped on with his coat, and waited while the Frau lighted the lantern.
"Now then, finished at last. Come along."
"The lamp, Rosa," warned the Frau, slamming the front door behind them. Snow had not fallen all day. The frozen ground was slippery as an ice pond. She had not been out of the house for weeks past, and the day had so flurried her that she felt muddled and stupid, felt that Rosa had pushed her out of the house and her man was running away from her.
"Wait, wait," she cried. "No, I'll get my feet damp. You hurry."
It was easier when they came into the village. There were fences to cling to, and leading from the railway station to the Gasthaus, a little path of cinders had been strewn for the benefit of the wedding guests. The Gasthaus was very festive. Lights shone out from every window. Wreaths of fir twigs hung from the ledges. Branches decorated the front doors, which swung open, and in the hall, the landlord voiced his superiority by bullying the waitresses, who ran about continually with glasses of beer, trays of cups and saucers, and bottles of wine.
"Up the stairs, up the stairs," boomed the landlord. "Leave your coats on the landing."
Herr Breckenmacher, completely overawed by this grand manner, so far forgot his rights as a husband as to beg his wife's pardon for jostling her against the banisters in his effort to get ahead of everybody else. Herr Breckenmacher's colleagues greeted him with acclamation as he entered the door of the Festal, and the Frau straightened her brooch and folded her hands, assuming the air of dignity becoming to the wife of a postman and the mother of five children. Beautiful indeed was the Festal. Three long tables were grouped at one end, the remainder of the floor space cleared for dancing. Oil lamps hanging from the ceiling shed a warm, bright light on the walls decorated with paper flowers and garlands, shed a warmer, brighter light on the red faces of the guests in their best clothes. At the head of the centre table sat the bride and bridegroom, she in a white dress trimmed with stripes and bows of coloured ribbon, giving her the appearance of an iced cake all ready to be cut and served in neat little pieces to the bridegroom beside her, who wore a suit of white clothes much too large for him, and a white silk tie that rose halfway up his collar. Grouped about them, with a fine regard for dignity and precedence, sat their parents and relations, and perched on a stool at the bride's right hand, a little girl in a crumpled muslin dress with a wreath of forget-me-nots hanging over one ear. Everybody was laughing and talking, shaking hands, clinking glasses, stamping on the floor. A stench of beer and perspiration filled the air. Frau Breckenmacher, following her man down the room after greeting the bridal party, knew that she was going to enjoy herself. She seemed to fill out and become rosy and warm as she sniffed that familiar festive smell. Somebody pulled at her skirt and, looking down, she saw Frau Rupp, the butcher's wife, who pulled out an empty chair and begged her to sit down beside her.
"Fritz will get you some beer," she said. "My dear, your skirt is open at the back. We could not help laughing as you walked up the room with the white tape of your petticoat showing."
"But how frightful," said Frau Breckenmacher, collapsing into her chair and biting her lip.
"Nah, it's over now," said Frau Rapp, stretching her fat white hands over the table and regarding her three mourning rings with intense enjoyment. "But one must be careful, especially at a wedding."
"And such a wedding as this," cried Frau Ledermann, who sat on the other side of Frau Breckenmacher. "Fancy Theresa bringing that child with her. It's her own child, you know, my dear. And it's going to live with them. That's what I call a sin against the church for a freeborn child to attend its own mother's wedding." The three women sat and stared at the bride, who remained very still, with a little vacant smile on her lips, only her eyes shifting uneasily from side to side. "Beer they've given it too," whispered Frau Rupp. "And white wine and an ice. It never did have a stomach. She ought to have left it at home." Frau Breckenmacher turned round and looked towards the bride's mother. She never took her eyes off her daughter, but wrinkled her brown forehead like an old monkey, and nodded now and again very solemnly. Her hands shook as she raised her beer mug, and when she had drunk, she spat on the floor and savagely wiped her mouth with her sleeve. Then the music started,
and she followed Teresa with her eyes, looking suspiciously at each man who danced with her.
"Cheer up, old woman," shouted her husband, digging her in the ribs. "This isn't Teresa's funeral."
He winked at the guests, who broke into loud laughter.
"I am cheerful," mumbled the old woman, and beat upon the table with her fist, keeping time to the music, proving she was not out of the festivities.
"She can't forget how wild Teresa has been," said Frau Ledermann. "Who could with the child there? I heard that last Sunday evening Teresa had hysterics and said she would not marry this man. They had to get the priest to her."
"Where is the other one?" asked Frau Breckenmacher. "Why didn't he marry her?"
The woman shrugged her shoulders.
"Gone. Disappeared. He was a traveller, and only stayed at their house two nights. He was selling shirt buttons. I bought some myself, and they were beautiful shirt buttons. But what a pig of a fellow. I can't think what he saw in such a plain girl, but you never know. Her mother says she's been like fire ever since she was 16.
Frau Breckenmacher looked down at her beer and blew a little hole in the froth.
"It's not how a wedding should be," she said. "It's not religion to love two men. Nice time she'll have with this one," Frau Rupp exclaimed. "He was lodging with me last summer, and I had to get rid of him. He never changed his clothes once in 2 months, and when I spoke to him of the smell in his room, he told me it was sure it floated up from the shop. Ah, every wife has her cross. Isn't that true, my dear?"
Frau Breckenmacher saw her husband among his colleagues at the next table. He was drinking far too much, she knew, gesticulating wildly, the saliva spluttering out of his mouth as he talked.
"Yes," she assented. "That's true. Girls have a lot to learn."
Wedged in between these two fat old women, the Frau had no hope of being asked to dance. She watched the couples going round and round. She forgot her five babies and her man and felt almost like a girl again. The music sounded sad and sweet. Her roughened hands clasped and unclasped themselves in the folds of her skirt. While the music went on, she was afraid to look anybody in the face, and she smiled with a little nervous tremor around the mouth.
"But my God," Frau Rupp cried, "they've given that child of Teresa's a piece of sausage. It's to keep her quiet. There's going to be a presentation now. Your man has to speak."
Frau Breckenmacher sat up stiffly. The music ceased, and the dancers took their places at the tables. Herr Breckenmacher alone remained standing. He held in his hands a big silver coffee pot. Everybody laughed at his speech, except the Frau. Everybody roared at his grimaces, and the way he carried the coffee pot to the bridal pair, as if it were a baby he was holding. She lifted the lid, peeped in, then shut it down with a little scream and sat biting her lips. The bridegroom wrenched the pot away from her and drew forth a baby's bottle and two little cradles holding china dolls. As he dandled these treasures before Teresa, the hot room seemed to heave and sway with laughter. Frau Breckenmacher did not think it funny. She stared round at the laughing faces, and suddenly they all seemed strange to her. She wanted to go home and never come out again. She imagined that all these people were laughing at her, more people than were there in the room even, all laughing at her because they were so much stronger than she was. They walked home in silence. Herr Breckenmacher strode ahead. She stumbled after him. White and forsaken lay the road from the railway station to their house. A cold rush of wind blew her hood from her face, and suddenly she remembered how they had come home together that first night. Now they had five babies and twice as much money. But, "Nah, what's it all for?" she muttered. And not until she had reached home, prepared a little supper of meat and bread for her man, did she stop asking herself that silly question. Herr Breckenmacher broke the bread onto his plate, smeared it round with his fork and chewed greedily. "Good?" she asked, leaning her arms on the table and pillowing her breast against them.
"But fine."
He took a piece of the crumb, wiped it round his plate edge, and held it up to her mouth. She shook her head.
"Not hungry," she said. "But it is one of the best pieces and full of fat."
He cleared the plate, then pulled off his boots and flung them into a corner.
"Not much of a wedding,"
he said, stretching out his feet and wriggling his toes in the worsted socks.
No,
she replied, taking up the discarded boots and placing them on the oven to dry. Herr Breckenmacher yawned and stretched himself, and then looked up at her, grinning.
"Remember that night we came home? You were an innocent one, you were."
"Get along. Such a time ago I forget." Well, she remembered.
"Such a clout on the ear you gave me.
but I soon taught you. Oh, don't start talking. You've too much beer. Come to bed. He tilted back in his chair, chuckling with laughter. That's not what you said to me that night. God, the trouble you gave me. But the little Frau seized the candle and went into the next room. The children were all soundly sleeping. She stripped the mattress off the baby's bed to see if he was still dry, then began unfastening her blouse and skirt. Always the same, she said. All over the world the same, but God in heaven, but stupid. Then even the memory of the wedding faded quite. She lay down on the bed and put her arm across her face like a child who expected to be hurt, as Herr Breckenmacher lurched in.
I'm John McDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was Frau Breckenmacher Attends a Wedding by Catherine Mansfield, read by Harry Dobby. Thank you to Bookstream Audiobooks for making that reading available. Next, it's time for the last part of a 1993 interview with long-term Eastbourne resident Mary Hunt.
You must remember this, a kiss is still a kiss.
Greenwood Street, when you first came here in 1933.
The post office was there, and there was a big shop there. There was a library, and they sold odds and ends of things. There was a butcher's shop, and behind the butcher's shop, there was a baker's place where they baked bread. And then there was a corner dairy. I can't remember what was where the Chinaman is now, because the Chinaman shop was over where the clothes shop is, opposite.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's called either.
Right.
Anyway, because there are a lot of new shops that have been altered.
True.
Anyway, the Chinaman shop was there on the opposite side. And then there was another bookshop there, and a plumber's shop. The chemist was there. And there was a men's hairdresser on that side, and a tobacconist. And then there was the picture theatre.
The Royal?
Yes, yeah. And they had a sweet shop in the entrance there. And then opposite, on the corner of, what's that street it is?
Arroyo Street.
Arroyo Street. There was another grocer's shop there. And then going down towards the wharf was the fire brigade hall.
Is that where Rona House is now?
Yes.
Yes.
And then there were several little shops in Arroyo Street just going down. One was a watchmaker, and there was a hairdresser there. I can't remember. I think the other was a little drapery shop or something like that, but I can't remember. Also, there was a drapery shop between the fire station and the corner grocers. I can't remember their name either.
That was there when we came.
Yeah.
Men's wear too.
It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. And the world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.
Be on holiday and enjoy the holiday with us.
Mm-hmm.
And for the second 3 weeks, he would commute on the tow bar or the Muratai, mm-hmm. go back to work at Sago Sun and Nguyen. And we used to have great times over here.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the Royal Picture Theatre.
Yes.
Because it was the first time in my life, I was about 10 years of age, that I ever went to a movie at night time.
Yes.
And I can still remember the name of the movie. It was Nelson Eddy and Janet McDonald in Naughty Marriott.
Yes.
Do you remember that one?
Yes,
it was a good one.
Oh, yes, in the Royal Theatre. all we old residents, we had our permanent seats for Saturday night. And you only rang up if you were not going to use them. And it was like a club, because all the old residents all had the same seats and we all met. And at half time there was a rush out to the ice cream store for the ice creams. That's all I can think of.
Yeah, and all the men folk had a cigarette.
Oh yes, I suppose.
Yes.
And the policeman was always standing out on the street there.
Remember the owner was Mr. Fisher.
Aye.
Do you remember him? Mary?
Oh yes. Right. Yes, he was the mayor when we first came over here, Mr. Fisher.
You know the little antique shop in Muirutai Road about opposite the police station? I understand
yes.
That used to be a grocery shop owned by Mr. Wise.
Yes.
Who was later mayor.
He was later mayor.
Yes.
And he lived in the house opposite. He built that two-story house opposite there. And also
where the shearers are now.
Yes.
Yes.
He also baked bread. Behind that shop.
Hmm.
I wasn't over there when the shop was opened. I've only been over there once or twice.
I see.
And the last time I went, we walked up to come out at Muirutai Park.
Yes.
I had my sister-in-law and her husband who are from Auckland, and she's a great native plant woman.
I see.
She's written books galore on it. She's now revising her first book.
Yes.
That she wrote on native plants. And we lost the track.
Oh.
We went in, it was going to be my daughter's birthday, and so we picked up the cousins that lived in the bay,
yes.
Young girls, and we all went over there at 10 in the morning. We came out at 7 at night.
Oh. You must have been well lost.
We came out of Muirutai Park.
Oh, yes.
Our husbands were motoring up and down the streets looking for us, and we were very worried because we'd got into them over there. We didn't get lost exactly, but it took us a long time to find the right track to come out of here. And then coming down that steep hill, I was in bed for about 3 days.
Oh, yes.
I was aching so much and so sore.
Yes.
I said, I'll never go back there unless I go in an aeroplane. But it was beautiful.
Yeah.
What's it like today? Have you been?
I haven't been over for 12 months, but there's nothing at Butterfly Creek now.
No.
I mean, in the 20 years that I've been here. But I remember it as a kid, when I was about 10 years of age, but that would be back in 1936, and we came over each year at Christmas time. And it was a beautiful place.
Mm.
Beautiful lawns, better than the bowling club lawns.
Yes.
And a man by the name of Carrington, I think, was running a little shop there, and he used to come over each day during the week with a 40-pound pack or 60-pound pack of soft drink bottles each day, so that he'd have enough for the weekend. The following week, he'd carry back the empties and bring out more bottles. And they had ice cream there, too. How they did that, I don't know.
In those days, the boys, the trampers used to come over, you know, to go over to Wainuiomata, over the hills there, and they used to go over through Butterfly.
That's right.
And a track out to Wainui.
Yes.
And Munt Cottrell, you know, the carriers
from
Wellington.
Yes.
Well, Thelma Munt was a friend of mine, a school friend of mine, you see.
Yes.
And they had a car. We didn't have a car, but they had a car. And so they thought they'd take me for a drive. And we came round here. And the road was being sort of formed. It was all river boulders. And there were just two wheel marks, you know, where the cars fitted in.
And Mary, was that 1914?
Yes, 1914-15.
Yes.
And we came round here on this Sunday afternoon, because the car was an open car, you know, you could put the hood up if it was raining. And Thelma and I sat in the back seat, and it was one of our windy days. And we were scared we were going to be blown out of the car, and we were sitting on the floor. But I've never forgotten that. It was the high boulders, you know, either side of us, and in the middle, and just these two ruts to drive along.
And the car would have been an open tourer.
Oh, yes, it was a nice car.
Yes.
That was that.
How do you get on if you pass somebody coming the other way?
I don't know how you'd get on. There weren't many cars about in those days.
And, of course, in rough weather, you know, windy weather, the water would come over fairly frequently, I think.
Well, I don't remember that.
It's just about fixed now, though, I think.
Mary, can you tell us anything about the boats plied between here and Wellington?
Oh, okay. The mirror town.
Yes. Were you here in the time of the Duchess?
I've been on the Duchess before that, you know, but I don't think she was on the run then.
No, no.
No, but the Muratau and the Cobar were.
Yeah.
Yes, I can tell you something else. Well, one would run at 7 in the morning and the other one was at 8 in the morning. They would blow the siren 5 minutes before the boat was to leave the wharf. And we lived up on the hill at that time. And you'd look out and you'd see people oozing out from behind trees and things. You couldn't see any house or batch, and where'd they come from? And the men would have a tie in one hand and a piece of toast in the other, and they'd run. And they'd run down to catch the boat. If they missed the boat, they walked along the beach, and there was, what do you call that sand that you sink into?
Quicksand.
Quicksand, yes. Down by where the creek came out from the pavilion. And sometimes they'd go down in that, and sometimes they would be all right. And they'd run to go to Rona Bay, because the boat always tied up at Day's Bay at night time.
Yes.
And then it went to Rona Bay, you see, and they'd catch the boat there. So if they were lucky in Day's Bay, the people that were on the boat would put their hands out and drag them on into the wall. And then it was 1 in 3 return in those days. 1 and 3 pence. It was threepence to go from Day's Bay to Rona Bay on the boat. And you went, you see, there was no delivery from Eastbourne. So if it was a very windy day like it is today, you would walk round to Eastbourne and get your goods and come back on the boat.
Walk round with the wind behind you and come back on the boat into the wind.
Things and vice versa for the southerly, you see. And half the time they never even came round to the threepence. Mind you, it was depression days and it was a windfall if they didn't come round.
I can imagine.
The threepence in those days.
It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. And the world will always welcome lovers.
I'm Joe McDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was the late Mary Hunt's 1993 Historical Society of Eastbourne's interview. My next guest belongs to a local band that's been going for 40 years, and it launches its next album on the 19th of November at Meow Bar in Wellington. So I thought I'd get an early listen to the music, chat to one of the founders of the band, and share some of the new music here in the Hut Zone.
Alan Galloway, the title of the album is Anything You Want, and the band's name is Let's Planet. We've been around a long time. I guess we've been called indie sort of guitar, pop, rock sort of stuff. Quite melodic, you know, maybe a little bit dark pop, but I don't like that term, but people have used it in the past. And someone the other day called us the cult pop darlings or something, but I don't know where that came from. There's two of us to write. There's me and Caroline. She writes and sings her stuff, and I write and sing my stuff, and we both play and sing each other's songs. I guess about human frailty, I suppose, and human condition, and it's very hard to talk about your own songs in a way, and other people hear different things in them. It's basically people-orientated and songs about human frailty, I suppose, and stuff from the heart. But also, having said that, it's kind of got uplifting sort of melodies and little pop riffs and hooks and things like that. So a lot of the songs of the new album are like 3.5 minutes long, which is quite, you know, what we sort of do, 3.5 minute guitar pop songs.
What's been the inspiration behind recording this album?
Well, as I said, we've been around a while. We're celebrating 40 years of playing together.
Wow.
So that's a long time, probably before you were born.
No, please shoot. Nowhere near it.
That's cool. We had our first gig at the old Cricketers Arms pub in December 1985. So we've only put out, in those 4 decades, we've put out 4 albums and a best of and an EP. So we're not exactly prolific, but we thought we should celebrate. We don't play that often. We should celebrate. And we had songs, both me and Caroline had songs. We thought, let's do an album and just sort of celebrate that we're still playing music after all this time. So yeah, we've got a gig at Meow on the 19th of November. I want it St. Peter's and Kaikokoriki on the 29th. The album launches the 19th at Meow, yeah. So yeah, that was inspiration. We had songs and we thought, oh, we're just celebrating all this time of playing together.
Who are the current musicians in Let's Play Now?
By the 3 core members, there's me, Caroline Easter on drums and singing, and Murray Costello. He's been with us almost since the beginning. He plays in a few other bands too, like Wooden Box Band and Simple Animal. Yeah, most Wellington musicians, everybody plays in a whole lot of different bands.
Because you've got Murray in the band, that gives you the connection.
Different. Well, I'm those quite often too. I go over there to the music shops and I've got a good friend who works in Music Warehouse, Justin. Justin Reed's a great guy, really good guy. Always buy my stuff from him. So support the independent guy. So yeah, always in the hut. We're always in Petone, going to the cafes there, going to the Dutch shop, sort of about fortnightly trek over there.
All right. I'm convinced.
Yeah, that's good. you're a hut man, aren't you? You're a hut man, are you?
I am indeed. We're in Corocoro.
I was actually born in the Hutt Hospital, so that, you know, just a link there.
Oh, wow. That's completely Hutt all over you.
Yeah, there is. You're in the city. You're in the city. You're in the city with your dancers, pose, your rhythm and your grace. Inside the
did you all come together, the three of you, then to be in this band?
I started it back with a mate of mine called Nigel back in 85. Then Caroline used to join. We did a few gigs and she got sort of someone to play with the Chills. Martin Phillips rang up and said, look, we're off to Europe, do you want to come? So you couldn't turn it down. So we went to Europe. We were together then, and we went to Europe with the Chills, and Let's Planet were put on hold until we came back. We spent 1987 based in London with the Chills. She stopped drumming with them a year later, and we sort of carried on with Let's Planet, and we got a album deal with Pagan Records in Auckland, and we did 3 albums with them. So, yeah, just how it all came together. I had a common interest in a certain sort of music, I guess, sort of maybe indie pop sort of stuff, the Flying Nun sort of stuff. So, yeah, common interest, I guess, in music.
Now, Murray Costello is your Eastbourne member of the band. How did he come to join the band?
Well, when we came back from England from the Chills gig, I put an ad in the paper, as you used to do in those days, advertised for a bass player for Let's Planet, because we didn't have a bass player or anything. So, and he was the only guy who showed up. So he was in. And we've been mates with him and his wife Liz for about 38 years now, you know, seeing their kids grow up and that's seen my daughter grow up. So, yeah, he was the only guy who answered the ad. So, and a really good bass player, good musician. So, yeah, that was it. We clicked well and off we went. Better make a ladder in case you fall in. Or even better, fill the hole in. Quickly before she jumps in, 'cause 6 is half a dozen, only one can win. The name Let's Planet, where did that come from? No idea. Yeah. The original Planet lineup, we were sitting at a pub one day. We had a first gig and we needed a name. And it's from two different names, I think. Someone had Let Something and someone had said Planet, had Planets. And this, it suddenly just came together. It didn't make any sense. Let's Planet, people say. Or we call it Let's Panic sometimes. So, but I don't know. It's a crazy name. No one really liked it, but it sort of stuck. So no point in changing it. And it sort of became the name after a while. So, and people say you've got sort of environmental sort of connotations. And maybe it has. I don't know. But if that works, great.
The launch at the Meow Bar, how are you going to run that? What's your format going to be?
We've got the full band. We've got the three members, me, Caroline Murray, and we've got Tatiana, who's my wife, playing keyboards. And we've got a guy called Nigel Mitchell from Orange Farm Band playing second guitar. So we've got a full a five-piece band like we normally have. And we've got a guest violinist, Jo Moyer, who plays in Hobnail Boots. She's a violin player, so she's got a guest as well. So yeah, it's a full band, and we'll probably play for about an hour and a half. We'll have a little set in the middle of three songs where we break the band down to about a three-piece, then come back on with a four-piece band at the end. That's the plan. That's what we've been rehearsing. So we just had a rehearsal. We just finished about half an hour ago, so it's sounding good.
Is it all tracks on the new album that you'll be doing at the launch?
Yeah, a bit of the old stuff as well, some old things there. We're doing quite a bit of the album and maybe a song or two from previous albums. We had a couple of songs on the radio way back then, so we might play a couple of those. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see who the audience is, if people sort of have kept up with us or if the new ones there or whatever, or who turns up at all, you know. Never know, but you know, we'll have fun, whatever.
So you've been around 40 years. What's been some of the key changes in that time in the New Zealand music scene that, from your point of view, Alan?
It's only because we haven't changed at all. We've always been out of fashion. We've always been uncool. we're so uncool that we're probably cool. Yeah, we're just, I don't know, we sort of fell through the cracks of, we weren't quite sort of rough enough for Flying Nun, but we weren't polished enough to be on sort of big labels or anything like that. We're sort of fell in between, which is suited us. I quite like being there. You know, it's like being, rather than being the middle of the road, you're being the ditch, as Neil Young once said. I suppose lots of changes. You know, we just kept doing what we're doing, just melodic guitar pop, and all around us has been like the rap thing, hip hop, grunge. All this is coming, or not, it's come and gone, but we just play on doing what we do and not trying to be anything else. We had a couple of our records, we were a little bit noisy. We got sort of, fuzzed out guitar orientated for a while, but tried a few things out. But there's always been melody involved, you know. That's been our sort of catchphrase. But we had a few good breaks. I mean, we supported people like REM, Crowded House, Proclaimers, Throwing Muses. We had some really good international support throughout the years, so that's been good. Playing in front of 2,000 people in the town hall is quite a buzz.
Yes, okay. You sort of get how you are, which is probably the secret for why you've got to 40 years.
It could be, yeah. Well, just a love of playing music, actually, and just sort of writing songs, you know. It's great. Like playing these new songs at the album, they're fresh songs, and they're really nice. It's really fun to play new stuff. I mean, it's good to play the old stuff too, but new stuff just keeps you on your toes. It's just enjoyable playing them and just being together and just knowing that we can make music, and we just everything just clicks, falls into place, you know. It's great.
Have you got a loyal audience around the country for that sort of duration?
Yeah, we used to tour a lot. In the sort of early mid-90s, early 2000s, we were on the road quite a bit because it was easier, much cheaper to tour then. Not so much now. Venues have changed and closed down. But, yeah, we always had little fan base in each sort of town, like especially the South Island, Dunedin and Christchurch were really... Yeah, South Island was really well attended. Auckland, not so much, maybe. Different sort of scene up there and different vibe, but here in Wellington and South Island were really great. We did a lot of South Island stuff.
What about the Hut? Did you ever come out to the Hut to perform?
We might have won. I'd like to, actually. Now, we see this place called the Shed out there, and there used to be the Bluegrass Society. They had a venue that we were going to play at once, but I think they closed and moved somewhere else, so I'm not quite sure what's happening there. But yeah, we'd love to play at the Hut.
It's sort of the abandoned brewery.
That's the one.
They sort of got their gigs there now, and a lot of activity going on there. Yeah, Petone as well.
No, is that the old place? It used to be Entrees, is that right? That sort of be a European supermarket sort of thing. Was that
sort of what it used to be? Yeah, but it's in that sort of that zone. Yeah. That could quite likely be that.
No, I definitely want to check that out. That sounds like a really great place. I heard some good things about it. Yeah.
Now, you're also a guitarist for a regular part that we have here on the Hut Zone, Rebecca Burgess. How did that sort of accompanying partnership happen?
She was at an art show selling her poetry and photographs and stuff, and we were just walking around and saw her and said, I bought one of her books. And I always had the idea of, playing guitar or a bit of soundscape behind a poet or something like that. Like Patti Smith used to do in the early days before she had a group, she's just her and a guitarist. And I always thought, oh, that interesting concept. And I asked her if she'd be interested, and she said, yeah, let's give it a try. So it's interesting having guitar and a bit of noise behind a poet. And it sort of works, I think. Yeah, it's a different thing. I haven't seen it around here much or at all in New Zealand, but hopefully, it could work. But yeah, I always had liked working with other people and that thing outside of the band concept. When I'm not singing, I'm just providing a soundscape or something. That's how that came about. Yeah.
Love breaks, love lives, but sometimes love breaks. Love means everything. Sometimes it breaks everything. Sometimes it comes back. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it strips and falls and leaves the furniture behind in the barren room.
The best place to follow what Let's Planet's up to, where would that be?
Facebook, probably, I guess, the old Facebook thing. Music's on Bandcamp. I'm not sure about Spotify yet, but the album will be on Bandcamp. And yes, Facebook, I guess, is the best thing. Maybe Instagram. But at the moment, I guess Facebook, Instagram, and album will be on Bandcamp. You can get the physical album too in CD form, so that's just being printed at the moment. So it'll be available on a release day. We're a bit old school. I mean, we'd love to have vinyl too, but it's so expensive. So we might get one later. We might get some vinyl pressings done later on. But CDs apparently seem to be making a comeback, I was told by a guy in a record shop. So.
That tangible feel always goes down well, really. It's just like books as well.
You've got the artwork. You've got something to read about, about the band or something. It'll write up there. And it's always nice to have something to hold. Yeah, I think.
Your hopes for the future then, Alan, for Let's Planet. What's that?
We'll probably just keep on doing what we're doing. Like you said, we don't record very often, but we've got a whole bunch of new stuff, so we might do another album next year. We've got enough stuff for it. Just a matter of coming up with a bit of cash, that's all. It's not cheap at recording, but we record pretty fast, and we're pretty lo-fi. It's not too polished. We're, a bit rough around the edges, which is quite what I like. It's almost like our live sound, our recorded sound. And we're going to release another single, hopefully before Christmas. We did Use Me. We did a video for that. We'll probably do... put a second single out probably next month.
Yeah, I thought we'd go out with a track from the new album, which is Use Me. What's the backstory of Use Me there?
That's interesting, that song. It's the only song that Caroline and I have wrote together. We've written together. We've always write separately. She writes her stuff and I write my stuff and we sing our own stuff. But it was written ages ago. It's an old song, probably 20 years ago. We played it live but never recorded it properly until now. Never quite captured it. Yeah, and as I say, it's the only song. I did the music and she did the lyrics, and it's the only song in all these years we've written together, so which is interesting, and she sings it, and sort of quite catchy, got a bit of energy to it. The original track was recorded by a friend of mine out here in Plymouth in his garden shed about 10 years ago. It was written 20 years ago, recorded 10 years ago, then we re-recorded it just recently with the rest of the stuff to bring it up to date and polish it a bit. So, a bit of a long story to that song, but now it's finally up there, which is really good.
Look at all the fuss you're making. Here I am for the taking. Come on and use me. Come on and use me. We'll be right back.
was Let's Planet and Use Me, who launched their latest album, Anything You Want, at Meow Bar on the 19th of November, tickets from Meow's website. But that means it's the end of this week's show. Thanks to all my guests tonight, and a big thank you to you for listening to the show and supporting Wellington Access Radio. You can always listen again to the show as a podcast on the Hut Zone pages of accessradio.org.nz. If you have a suggestion of a hut story or a piece of musical poetry, then please do message us either on Facebook, John McDonald NZ, or email the team. And our email is thehutzone@outlook.co.nz. Let's go out with one piece of music from Halcyon Drift, Motivator. Until next Thursday, mate wā e noho uru mai rā. Stay well.
Around the dark, to strike the weary, to strike a spark, to wake the tide, to challenge the fool, and smash that sphere in half. To be honest and cruel, to be honest and cruel, to be honest and cruel.
The program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.